is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is 4:46 on February 19th, and we are going to begin the student assembly meeting. Chelsea, whenever you're ready, could you please call the roll?
He's
an exam.
Here.
On our agenda is open microphone, so I'm going to hand it over to EVP Batista.
Hello to those in the audience that aren't aware. Open microphone is the chance to bring up an issue or topic to the student assembly. If you'd like to do so at this time, please come forward to the table and state your name and year. If anyone else in the general membership would like to come forward, please do so at this time. And seeing none, we're going to close the microphone.
So now we are going to approve our February 12th meeting minutes. Are there any amendments on the floor or a motion?
Motion to approve.
Second.
There's been a motion to approve. There's been a second. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, I'm going to ask that we approve the minutes from last week by unanimous consent. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the minutes from last week are approved. So we are going to wait until 6 p.m. for our short presentation from the Judicial Code campers. And we're very excited to have them here. They'll be here at 6. Next, we're going to go into announcements and reports. First is by Representative Fridman.
Hi everybody, this is an announcement about Resolution 29, calls for the implementation of open course evaluation. As you all know, we passed this last semester. It's reviewed into the vacant president, and subsequently deferred by the president and by the interim provost, Harry Katz, following a meeting with the dean. It was explained as rationale for this that evaluations are a college level matter at Cornell, and despite a majority of us voting in favor, they will not be considered further. No requests for meetings were approved, despite multiple requests. I'll be presenting open course evals to the chairs meeting of the arts and sciences, college in March. I'll be doing this with various other colleges as well. If anybody's interested in working on this, please do let me know. Faculty on the Educational Policy Committee have been really receptive. We'll be bringing this forward probably through the GPSA and the UN at some point soon as well. There are a bunch of folks that worked on this last semester. If you're something you're still interested in, it'd be a really good time to jump on. There's a lot to be done. There's a lot of really fun things that we had with faculty trying to get into some of the stuff.
Cool.
All right, thank you.
So first, we're going to go into business of the day. We have Resolution 36, divestment from coal towards a sustainable endowment. So could the sponsors please move up to the front of the room? Just so everyone knows, there was a new version of the resolution that was printed a few weeks ago and given to you guys. The resolution that's in your agenda packet is actually an older version of it. So what we're going to do is have Matt hook up his computer to the projector for the new version. So if you guys can't find the newer version in your binder that has red writing on it, then you can refer to the projector. And if you can't see it, you can move around so that you can see it. Does that work for everyone? Yeah, I think we're going to try to, maybe move it a little bit. And anyone in the audience can also move to a position that they think they'll be able to see it better. Emma, whenever you're ready, you can begin. I think you can just leave it there. Is anyone having a hard time seeing it who needs to see it? I think some people are. So you can also refer to it on your laptop if you have to. Your laptop on your phone. Matt Henderson just sent it out.
Hi everyone. So I'm just re-presenting this resolution on solar investment. I have two amendments which are in red. So the first one is the most crucial, discussing that we're treating all investments that are directly in coal. So we have investments that are managed by outside investors that have groups of different things that we invest in. And then we have direct investments in certain companies. So we currently have no direct investment in coal, even if those legal portfolios might have some. So we're not asking in this resolution to pull it out of those folders of mixed ones. We're only asking to highlight the fact that we don't have any direct holdings in coal. So in the second round, it kind of goes to the fact that coal is continuing to produce poor financial returns. I don't have a PhD in economics, but the report that I read was written by people with PhDs in economics, and they signed a line at the end that says that they're impartial, and this is just the fact of how the industry is returning. And they say that the demand is declining for coal, and that the production costs are going to be unprofitable. So that's something that's reflected in the fact that we don't invest in it anymore. They're making this based on economic decisions, and we're just kind of trying to highlight that. The chief investment officer also stressed that we do not plan to invest in coal in the future directly. And I also added another layer on, kind of stressed the fact that we don't use coal on our campus. So I think it's easy to say it doesn't have anything to do with what's happening on the ground, but it clearly does when we have an entire initiative that we call Beyond Coal, which was in 2012 and 2011. So, and the last thing I added was, this is a statement that says that we hold the deceased public information. We saw a lot of things that we have knowledge of financial transparency, and this is a step in the right direction because it's highlighting something that's already occurred and that people haven't known about for 7 years, even though last year when Stanford did this, the entire country knew. So, like, I guess I'm just trying to stress the fact that, like, if we're doing something great, then, like, we should announce it, and people should know about it. Yeah, I don't have a couple to say.
So, Emma, if you want to move forward with the new version, technically we do have to amend it so that all of those amendments can be incorporated. So if you'd like to make a formal motion, I would encourage you to do that at this time.
I'm going to make a motion to accept the amendments that I've been.
Okay, so there's a motion on the floor, and there is many seconds. Is there any dissent to this? Seeing none, we will move into discussion on the amendment. Is there anyone who would like to speak on the amendment that Emma made? Rep. Keeley.
Yes, so just in line with the resolution that Joseph and Maria gave and Ben passed on the abstract, and just clarify your goals, can you provide an abstract of this resolution?
So, an abstract, sorry about that, I'm not going to be an abstract. The abstract that I said in the resolution is that the student assembly urges the administration to make public its investment goals and encourages the administration to not invest directly in their own future.
And I would also like to just point out that we haven't been able to work on the make a standardized format for the abstract yet because Juliana and the sponsors have yet to actually do that. That is not Emma's. And coordinate with the Daily Sun. So that's not Emma's fault, and that should not be held against her. I believe I saw Max Weisbrod's hand.
I just wanted to ask what percentage of Cornell portfolio is directly held, like, right through the
resolution? I don't have the answer to that, sorry. And I don't think that's pertinent exactly to the resolution itself.
Motion to call the
question. So there's been a motion to call the question on these amendments. Is there a second?
Second.
All right, is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will go into a vote on the amendment. Remember, it's a majority vote to pass amendments. Please raise your placard if you are in favor. Please raise your placard if you're opposed. Please raise your placard if you'd like to abstain. So by a vote of 22-0-0, all the amendments that are in red on that projector have carried through, and now we can go back into the discussion on the amendment, on the resolution as a whole. And I'd like to encourage anyone in the audience who would like to come forward and speak to do so and engage in the conversation, because you guys do get to vote on this resolution, considering that it is a recommendation. So now we are going to move on to the speakers list for the resolution itself. First is Representative Bacharach.
I'm going to come here to talk to you about this resolution. It's a great resolution. It's a great resolution. We're going to have this outlook on the people and the people of everyone who's been talking about the past 2 weeks. We're going to have to take a look at it.
Next is Liaison Battaglia.
Thanks for bringing back for us. I agree with that. I think the amendment for resolution is a great idea. I have an integration to use line 38 and 40, but I don't think that's enough to really. I think the resolution as a whole is really advertising for 3 PR. The state will make the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the Times for doing this. And we've been out of that. I don't see the reason why we shouldn't be advertising this, because it helps advertise for on the page to increase the rate.
Siobhan, did you want to speak? I thought I saw your hand. No?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. VP Tayal.
Yeah, I think this is a very well intentioned resolution. That of course could increase our PR. But I just had a few questions about about similar resolutions that have come to the SA before, and this is actually not a question just to Emma, it's actually to members who've been in the SA when I was in here, so I don't know the reason for this, but my question is that last semester, the last year, a resolution had come where we asked for disinvestment from because of a geopolitical issue, but we decided not to hear that because it was number one related to disinvestment, and number two, it was, and I'm assuming because it was related to a geopolitical issue. If we sort of accept this and if we sort of move forward with this, so those interested groups will come to us and say that, you know, you never listened to us then and now you're actually taking this. So can you just sort of give me a response to that and a sort of rationale to that? Thank you.
Was that a question for Emma?
For a question for Emma and you, for the president.
Emma, do you have anything to say? I think Emma, I can't really answer very differently than Emma. This is a different assembly where if everyone on this assembly would like to discuss and vote on this resolution, everyone on this assembly should feel entitled to do so. And if another resolution on another issue comes up regarding divestment on another topic, this assembly should feel free to act however they believe is right. Actually, next is Representative Friedman.
Yeah, so kind of two very conversation. An amazing resolution to definitely pass it today. I know it's a reason not to. The other is that steps have been taken by a lot of other universities. And I was watching them debate with Northwestern yesterday when they decided to disinvest by like 24-2 from six companies that were involved in deploying military across Israel. Just the general thing was that a lot of colleges in seeking to make kind of disinvestment decisions and students that feel that they have some sort of say in how the name of their school is used, how the capital of their school is used, right? We're all very enthused about providing capital to Cornell, presumably because we're interested in their conditions. They form responsible investing councils that work with the chief investment officers. I think that'd be a great step forward if we care about, you know, not intermingling with things like fossil fuels and other things that they pull this for the planet. So, yeah, I mean, I think that'd be a cool next step for anybody interested in this to talk about.
What? We have a very short speakers list, so if you'd like to respond, I'll allow it. Next is EVP Batista.
I yield my time.
All right, next is VP Stefanko.
Yeah, so as somebody who was on the assembly last year, I'll just respond to Vice President Payel's thought and why I don't think it's necessarily relevant to this resolution, because I do think it should be passed today. I think that last year, and I don't agree with the fact that we didn't actually debate the issue. I think the issue should have been debated, but those sorts of issues are a little bit harder for us to come down on because we're supposed to be expressing the sentiment of students, and I think the resolution that was brought to us last year was an issue that was divided between students, and I think it would have been tough to author an opinion on it that would have said definitively yes, we should divest, or definitively no, because students on either side would have had issues with that. But with something like this, you're talking about an industry that arguably is already not economically profitable, but definitely won't be profitable in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, which is why they decided to not invest in it, and it's an industry that we know has major implications on the environment, and that's why that decision was made. So I think that on an issue where most students can agree that investing in coal most likely is probably not a good thing, if you talk to people and said it's a dying industry and it's probably, you know, it's definitely hurting the environment, I think most students would say, you're right, like, we would agree with that, which is something that I don't think would have happened with the issue last year, which is why this should be passed.
All right, Before I move on to the second speakers list, is there anyone who hasn't spoken yet who would like to speak, including a member of the audience? Okay, Rapper Point.
Yeah, I'm in support of the resolution. I don't support every part of it, personal opinion. But all the same, I think that what differentiates human responsibility, what Matt Fongo says, is basically that the universe has sustainability on its agenda.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be on the first speaker's list? Is there anyone I'm missing? All right. I am going to move on to the second speaker's list. If you'd like to speak and you haven't spoken yet, just raise your placard. First is Representative Achilles.
Yes, I wanted to respond to Matthew Shabon's comments when I recall the question, but I just think that Shabon brought a really good point that we shouldn't be diminishing the seriousness of this resolution. Coal is a hotly debated issue across this country. There are communities that, in the country that rely on coal. It is a geopolitical issue. Unlike Matt said, coal is huge across this country. It is the leading source of energy in our nation. So, can we get that wrong? No, I looked, I looked at the graphs. So we should be considering that some of the, when we talk about these issues, there are communities that are very sensitive. The reason that this gets fed deep in other issues is that Cornell as a whole, we don't necessarily represent those communities across the country, but it is a very obvious issue. And we should consider this in that way.
All right, next is DP Tayal.
Personal opinion is that this is an extremely important issue and an extremely positive move. So that's my personal opinion. Now, in terms of the motives of this resolution, well, it's something that's not currently being done. Some members said this could give the essay good PR, so that's one motive. And the second motive is, of course, it could reaffirm essay's support to sustainability. So that's fair enough. But if you look at the essay's precedent, our precedent previously has been that we are not going to look at issues concerning geopolitical or geopolitics or any geopolitical issues, and this is as geopolitical as any other issue. The only reason why I abstain or not vote on this is because this probably would suggest that the essay is biased against and prejudiced against certain groups, because we did not listen as a whole to other groups, and now we're sort of taking up this geopolitical issue. So just going by the precedence of this institution, I would not want to vote on this, but personally I'm extremely for this, and I believe that this is a great initiative. But yes.
And just as a point of clarification, this is a newly elected assembly. If it's not written in our rules, you can do what you want. Next is Representative Fridman.
We were kind of late, as I remember, on like the South African apartheid train. We're pretty sure we digested there. I'm pretty sure we digested. I don't think there's any reason not to consider this one, because we didn't consider a highly contentious, highly politicized discussion last year, and we saw what happened when we
motion to call the question.
So there's been a motion to call the question. There's been a second. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will move into voting on this resolution. Because it is a recommendation, and I will read a little blurb, people in the audience will get to vote if they so choose. Divestment from coal towards a sustainable endowment is a recommendation. It will require a majority vote of SA members present to pass. Two community votes will also be allocated to the side with the majority vote. So for everyone, for all community members who are here, I will ask you to raise your hand if you're in favor, opposed, or would like to abstain from this vote. Abstentions do count as no votes if there are more abstentions than yeses, just so you know how that works. So just raise your hand, and then I will count two votes from whatever majority there is. If you are in favor of this amendment, or this recommendation. If you're from the audience and not an elected member of the SA. If you're elected, yeah. Okay, keep your hands up.
Okay.
Two hands is cheating. If you're opposed.
Are there any others?
And if you'd like to abstain.
Okay.
By a vote of 10 to 1 to 1, there will be two community votes going towards the total in favor. So if you're on the student assembly and you approve of this recommendation, please raise your flag. If you're opposed, if you'd like to abstain.
Abstention? Okay.
So by a total vote of 22 to 1 to 1, this resolution passes. Thank you very much, Emma. All right. Next on our agenda is Resolution 46, opposing the health fee. Oh, I'm so sorry. That was my mistake. I was looking at the wrong thing. It is Resolution 43 addressing sexism. That would be silly. Sorry. I was flipped to the wrong page.
I said sexism.
What? Yeah, it's it. No, you haven't just been right.
Okay, guys, just so you know, so you don't get confused like I did, Resolution 46 is actually before Resolution 43 in your agenda packet, so don't think you lost it. Yeah. All right. Well, the good news is the Resolution 46 was on the agenda last week, so you should have it. So please refer to your version from last week for Resolution 46. And for now, everything for Resolution 43 should be in place. And now I will give Phyllis and Siobhan 4 minutes to introduce.
Yeah, so this is a resolution that has been brought here by the efforts of Philip and within the LGBTQ Resource Center. I'm just going to introduce how we came up with this. KDAC meets twice every month, and KDAC actually has a list of issues we want to cover, issues that administration of KDAC said that were extremely important in those sexism, addressing sexism and developing preferred pronouns is actually one of the key issues. So my primary role here has been to help the representatives, the LGBTQ representatives, along with the LGBTQ Resource Center to develop a draft of this resolution that gives the essay opinion of this matter. And I think Philip can now talk more about what it is. So,
So basically, the sexism for all those who are unaware basically assumes that someone's gender identity and their sex are the same, and that it really disregards the fact that gender is a social construct. So I have been stuck in many different offices, including the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, the LGBTQ Resource Center, Haven, who also the Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity, who all approve this resolution and who all will be working with me to help ensure that we are able to accommodate all trans identifying people, just as we are people who are not trans. So in case you're wondering, according to the Hurtado Report, queer and trans people are often very uncomfortable in academic environments for a variety of different reasons, such as the professors being commonly misgendering them, as well as all aspects of our university and society, which are very based in gender binaries. So this is really just a preliminary step, and as Siobhan mentioned, I do hope that we will be able to implement some type of system where we will have where we are students have the ability to indicate their preferred pronouns, as well as have the ability to easily change their gender identity on all intra-university forms. Thank you.
And just before we finish, in case someone who doesn't know what preferred pronouns means, it means that any individual has the choice to use any pronoun they want. The pronoun does not have to be aligned with their biological sex.
All right, so are you guys concluded with your introduction? Okay. Excellent. First on our speakers list is Representative Alipon.
So I find it great that you're working on actually this a more inclusive university. I was just wondering what the thought of why you went a route of trying to get the university to switch forms collect information instead of being more of a recommending more of educational kind of things, because I feel like a lot of people don't, like, to be honest, I barely knew how to say a word, so like, and a lot of people don't. So I was wondering why the resolution is geared towards making sure that professors understand the concept so they can, better help their students.
Yeah, we have a short speakers list, so for now you guys can respond to everyone as long as it's under 2 minutes. So if the speakers list gets longer, I'll make sure that we do every two, okay?
So I definitely agree with you. I definitely think there does need to be more education for both students, professors, staff. There really does need to be more educative measures about gender identity on campus. But I feel as if that's a separate issue, and it basically just has to do with lots of different demographic information in the way the university handles it. For example, on student center, you can only choose whether you're male or female, and you can't choose if you don't identify within this gender binary. And because different professors do get this form, if you get the little printout with your pictures on it and all that, they do see that, they do just look at the picture and they do assume that you use whatever pronouns are associated with whatever your gender expression may stereotypically look like that you want to.
Great, thanks.
And just to add to that, I just want to also reflect, and I think this is a great point to raise in terms of possibly a shortcoming we can address later, but just to add to that, having spoken to the administration and having spoken to members of the LGBTQ Resource Center, they said that this is what is required the most. This is something that's already being considered as a register and vote for the SA, which is give another push to this. This is literally me quoting them. So.
Next is DOE Aniket.
I think while the intent of this resolution is indeed very noble, there are certain clauses here which are very vague, and I think this is an endemic problem with a lot of resolutions that have passed. For instance, if you look at line number 30, the last read resolved sentence. I think this is a very, very broad and ambiguous statement that is being made, and this recommendation can be interpreted in all sorts of ways. You can recommend the university to eradicate all forms of discrimination, for instance. or all forms of stigma. Anything can be substituted for the word. So if you have to make it more enforceable, you have to make it more specific.
Great. And I think this is something I casually agree with earlier definitions too, and I think it's a great point. But just to reaffirm and reiterate the objective of this resolution, based on administration we've spoken to in the CD and based on higher level officials we've spoken to, and when we ask them, you know, what's the requirement, how can we possibly contribute to this specific issue, they said that this is something that's already been considered by the registrar's office and a vote by the SA with a genuine support towards the cause will only push their case, and that's why we wanted to make it as genuine as possible. But since you have gained the point of specificity, I really appreciate you came up with a certain point from me right now or contacted us after the votes meeting to help add specificity to this resolution. We'd be much needed to work with that.
Next is President Emeritus Smith.
So I don't know what this is for those who don't know. I actually work in the Department of Inclusion and Workforce Diversity. We didn't necessarily approve this, but we have actually offered some insight and actually said that it was forwarded by it. So my job is to, I'm a coordinator for inclusion and compliance program. So basically I work with a lot of federal clients or law. Anyway, so there are a lot of things that are actually true here in terms of your work process. Specifically that we are required by law to report on legal effects because that's their federal contractor. However, there are new executive orders released by the President Obama that will now require us to actually disclose or not determine sexual orientation or gender identity, which is great in my opinion. However, the thing is, there are a couple of things here. Your members have to agree with your director of elections. It's a big phase, and that's kind of a problem for us. Just simply because we're not already allows you to change your sex on your inclusion center, and it's not just female. There are a couple of things. There are a lot of people, employees and students. You can also change your name, your legal name. So there are a couple of other things. And you don't have to, unlike the one according to the university, who actually allow you to do that without proof of medical intervention. So that's a very big deal that a lot of people don't know about. But really, I'll just skip ahead and focus on your actual whatever your BF, therefore, without problems. We would suggest that you, I think I can know this to you, that should actually say in one of the documents where demographic information is collected, provides undergraduate students the option to choose their preferred gender or gender identity. I'm not going to do anything. I can't do that. Things you can't actually add because of the law. So there is, while the executive order that came out did not prohibit us from collecting information about gender identity or sexual orientation, they also require it to because there are confidentiality issues. So if you ask for things, the big question is, are you going to get accurate data? Because nobody knows what you're going to get that information. If an undergraduate applies for admission and you require them to answer whether or not they identify with the LGBTQ community or to provide, if they provide a gender identity that differs from what their legal sex is, and all of a sudden point out that they're information about the LGBT resource center and stuff like that, and their parents do that and they're out for their parents for anything, that's when it becomes a problem. So that's where we have to be careful with that. And I agree with you that the resolution actually like that idea. I think there should be paths. I just think there should be specificity just in terms of where you want us to collect that information from and then how you want that information to be. The only place that require that we truly require control in your jurisdiction that you require undergraduates to do that would be the admissions application. Because Cornell surveys, all Cornell surveys already do, including the policy employees that they already do allow, or they ask gender identity as well as legal studies. Those are the
yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much. And for anyone on this assembly who would like to formally make the amendments that Ulysses was suggesting, you can feel free to do so, because you do have the power to motion to amend. In the meantime, we will... You can respond to me.
Yeah, sorry, I apologize for continuing, but when I said administrators, I met people on CNAC and very specific people we contacted, and I apologize for overlooking any advice given, but I think given that it's from someone from the administration or someone who is so closely involved with this issue, I would encourage members of the assembly to possibly make amendments. Can we make the amendment?
You can make an amendment, of course you can. You should probably think of the language. It's new business, but you can still do it. So think of the language that you would like to propose, and once you have the language written down and ready to go, then just motion to amend at any time as long as no one else is speaking. Is that okay? So then I'm going to move down the speakers list, as long as that's all right. First is Representative Yang.
Thank you for bringing that up. My question is really, again, regarding the line 24 for the information. I just wanted to ask what you said about the release of the information, or rather, what also what information is coming to.
Well, you're just going to touch on what I said earlier about what we were hoping to do with preferred pronouns. What a lot of other universities do, such as Columbia, Princeton, and University of Vermont, they allow students to indicate their sex identity or their gender identity as well as their preferred pronouns. So that way, professors and other students are able to know what their preferred pronouns actually are. That would be an initial question.
Franklin, could you speak into the mic?
Well, I guess it could just be in all forms of every single thing that the university has that relates to demographic information. This would be another demographic information. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Awesome. Next is VP Stefanko.
Awesome.
All right, he yields his time. So next is Representative Bridman. Also, if there's anyone in the audience who would like to speak at any time, just remember to raise your hand. I see some new faces. Moving on, we will have Representative Bakili speak next.
I yield.
All right. Did you want to respond? No. Next is Representative Lapointe.
Oh, you the motion?
Yeah. So just overall, I don't think I'm making the room is quite a lot, for some equipment, so I think there should be a set of work around. All I think what you need to do here. Okay, but on top of that, I just wonder, I don't know if I could see a lot, but do you know any of the technical personnel requirements?
Well, I do not know the financial requirements, but I would imagine that they are very small. That's just...
Yeah,
you can... ...with the resolution until after the discussion of the resolution 46, which is a big time. And then you make amendments.
Okay, so there's been a motion to table. Has there been a second? All right, but there was dissent. Siobhan, you have 30 seconds to explain your dissent.
We just finished.
Okay, so he withdraws the motion. You're going to let that one slide. All right. Would you guys like to respond to what Rep. LaPointe was saying? Were you? Okay. Okay. There's a lot going on. Next is VP Bhandari. Okay. I only have two hands.
I think this resolution is a great idea, and I think it really tackles a big issue that I think even some people on the assembly, you know, this is one of those new issues that I think is really it's growing, and I think this is good for us to really understand initially now, too. So I'm just kind of wondering what efforts the university has taken in general towards addressing this so far. I know Lizzie's addressed some of them, but I was just wondering if there are any other things that are in motion with regards to addressing cis sexism on the whole scale.
So a major question is actually during the admissions process. So the Common Act application does not actually, I'm sorry about the name, the Common Act actually does not recognize preferred pronouns, and that makes it a huge difficulty for us to collect data at that specific stage of students entering the entering college to actually collect data on that. And I think the amendments that you see is making also addresses that. More than that, while the pulse surveys, as we said, do have the option to sort of identify with a specific gender, we were actually looking at a more large or more broader university policy towards preferred pronouns.
What? Okay.
But then, but they don't actually in their specific form.
On the Cornell supplement, they do not have any information regarding gender identity. However, many other universities do. Yeah.
All right.
Motion to amend.
There's a motion to amend on the floor. I think, Ben, do you have to speak right now before you have to go? BJ. Sorry, I just wanted to be respectful.
No worries. Hi, everyone. My name is BJ Seifert. I'm the current vice chair of the Toy Assembly. I'm sitting right here however many years ago myself. As you just mentioned, things like this really are helpful if we incorporate all the shared government bodies here on campus, especially the employees and staff. So I know she's working very diligently with the Nicole Howell, who's also on the employee assembly, and we'd like to work with you on things like this. So in addition to issues like this, other things that affect the whole Cornell community, and encourage all of you to reach out to us and work on things as well, too. So keep that in mind.
All right. Thanks, BJ. So you can continue with your motion, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so motion to amend the resolution. If Chelsea actually the specific language of the amendment is with Chelsea, so she can read it out. And this is just to clarify that this is word to word from what we suggested. We actually explain the rationale both in why specificity in this regard would make sense, and we could further discuss that.
Therefore, resolved that the student assembly recommends that the university collect information regarding LGBTQ+ status by inserting voluntary demographic options, including sexual orientation and gender identity, in addition to data about legal sex as required by the federal government, into the undergraduate application for admission. Anybody else have a question? Okay. Second amendment is to begin further resolve calls right after that on line 27. Again, I'm just gonna read how it's gonna read. So be it further resolved that all intra-university forms and documents or demographic information is collected, provide undergraduate students the option to choose their preferred gender or gender identity. Anyone want that to begin? Okay, that's it.
And just to reiterate, as we mentioned informally, the primary voluntary has been added because it's required to be voluntary, and it's been directed towards the admissions process because currently, as Philip just said, this is currently something that's not being followed by college.
Great. So I am going to ask that we discuss both of these amendments at once. I know that's a little bit of a bend of our rules, but I think it'll be less confusing. Is that okay with everyone? So we will discuss and vote on both of these amendments at once. Great. So is there anyone who would like to speak on these amendments? Rep. Alexander.
So regarding the in-person versus home, I know that the university was operating under for different database processes and things like that, I'm not too sure how inclusive that vendors are. So I was wondering how you plan on working with them for the university issue. I was wondering how you plan on working with them, because sometimes it's not, even if the university has good intentions, it's just that the systems that they use are not.
So yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong, but we largely do use PeopleSoft, I think, for most data collection for students in the intra-university level. So I think the question is just very important because it would take a lot of resources to actually, you know, change this data in PeopleSoft, and that's something that, again, universities will only do once they have the resources, time to do that. So I think the primary way, again, would be to create more advocacy about this issue among students. And as you guys said, many students don't know what the first pronouns are. When I came to contact, I didn't know. So largely, creating advocacy among students and then possibly, you know, directing this advocacy towards the university to say that, you know, this is something we've realized and this is something that needs to be changed.
Yeah, so I agree with all of that and going off of that. I just have one more thing to add, and that it's important to keep in mind this is a recommendation, so it's just a preliminary step. So, like, little details like that, we're not going to be entirely able to work out right now as it stands, but that we can address in the future.
So, next on the amendment is Representative Lee.
So, I think this is a recommendation, and I'm going to move forward with it. I think it's a question about what we were talking about. So it seems like all of this is geared towards the entering freshman students and transfer students. So what happens for those of us who are already here, and like, how are we kind of trying to get the word out on and around campus for people that are, like, I guess my question is just kind of looking at the future of the organization.
Wait, so are you asking what, how will the university collect this demographic information for students who already go here? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us didn't know that Connect has not just listened up. Nobody really knew that, or at least I didn't, because I know a lot of people don't really know that Connect recognizes non-binary gender identity. And so, like, what can we put into place to kind of, like, promote that?
Okay.
You can yield your time to Ulysses if you'd like.
Let me just reiterate what we've done for us in terms of the amendment. The first resolve was very specific, because currently the resolution actually doesn't have any provision for students who are going to be admitted in the future, and that's actually the main problem. That's the main issue arising, because common application doesn't have a separate space audit where you can, give a preferred pronoun. So we actually changed like this to say that, okay, we're first going to meet with students on the common corner and actually make a provision in our admission form where we can allow students to voluntarily provide information about the preferred preferred pronoun, and then move to whatever we have.
Being held up in front of the testifying group, that pronouns very centralized, so every unit does something totally different to the way we collect information. Aside from the undergraduate application, pretty consistent for the most part in terms of demographic questions. So by adding that, you're capturing anybody who's entering, but the second result is actually capturing current audience. So if anybody is doing a survey in addition to the employee survey or the poll, which is under that if you take voluntary, anything like that, that's what it is. Which is, and this question is actually already asked on the poll, just so you're very clear. So that's our definition.
Yeah, thank you. Is there anything else you guys would like to add before I move on to the next speaker? Excellent. Next is, actually, we've expired our speakers list for the amendment. Okay, so there's a motion to vote on the amendment. There is a second. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will vote on these amendments as Chelsea read them. So if you are in favor of the amendments as Chelsea read them, please raise your placard. If you're opposed. And if you'd like to abstain. So by a vote of 22-0-0, those amendments do pass. And now we'll move back into discussion on the resolution as a whole. We still have some people on our first speakers list, and we also have a second speakers list that's starting to accumulate some names, so if you would like to get on the first speakers list, I'd encourage you to raise your hand sooner rather than later. Next is Rep. Johnson.
So I just wanted to say thank you for coming up. Even when I saw the resolution, I think this is something that people don't know about it, but I think when I saw the resolution, I like changed it to Google Default Bank a little bit more, so that's important to have some information. And I think that kind of shows how the resolution itself is sort of helping to the type of programs that we hold on campus and the type of education we can now receive daily. So I think it's a really big deal to start with the resolution because other than on campus can be programming, and we can too, but our job is to set the president to the time.
Awesome. You guys don't want to respond? Okay. Liaison to Tavia.
I think this is a fantastic resolution and a great idea. I'm supporting fully. I just wanted to ask if the students can tell you are, if you talk to the university assembly as well, they're coming out there to work with you, but they're going to be handling the idea of ensuring that structural renovations have been in the bathrooms more frequently. So I think that we are taking up, and it does need to be a little bit, so I think
would you guys like to respond? Okay. What? It's okay. Next is Representative Hassan. Do you still want to speak? Okay. I think I was confused that you're raising it while you're motioning. All right. We actually have expired our first speakers list, and before I move into my second speakers list, is there anyone who would like to speak who has not had the chance to speak yet, including someone from the audience? Okay. So there's been a motion to vote. There's been dissent. I'm actually not going to accept that motion because it is still new business. So if you'd like to motion again, you can motion to... So he's motioning to make this business of the day. There's been a second. Is there any dissent? All right. So there's dissent. Whoever would like to explain their dissent, choose one of you, and you have 30 seconds.
I think what we saw today was a great resolution, but definitely to be worked on. As you said many times before, you know, advocacy and getting the word out on this is very important, and for students to feel safe, especially in the classroom, for faculty, and I think that's definitely a part of the resolution that we're missing, is that we need to personally state that there needs to be more awareness and like more programs to make faculty and staff more inclusive.
All right, your time's expired. So basically, we're going to vote on whether to move this to business of the day or not, and if the motion to move it to business of the day fails, then it will remain new business. If the motion to move it to business of the day passes, then we can debate this in a more argumentative manner, and we can also eventually vote on it today, just to clarify for anyone who might be confused. So, if you would like to vote in favor of moving this to business of the day, could you please raise your placard? If you're opposed, and if you'd like to abstain. So by a vote of 15-8-0, we actually will move this to business of the day. So that means that we can continue with the people who were speaking. It just means that it is business of the day. You can feel free to make comments that are more argumentative in nature. Is there anyone who would like to be on the first speaker's list before I move on? VP Stepanko, you yielded your time before, so.
So I just want the sponsors to be comfortable with this, but I think we should motion to table this to next week. Like Syed said, I think this is a resolution that has a lot of great intentions, but, I mean, even in a very short period of time, Ulysses is able to add a lot of improvement, and it, you know, it seems like there's a lot more consideration that needs to be done on this resolution, something that maybe needs another week or two to sort of percolate within the administration and within what you're doing. So I won't formally make the motion, but, you know, I'd like to hear what your guys' thoughts are, and then maybe we can make it and then move on to another issue.
I think I'm happy to be all that, but in terms of the opinions Ulysses had, they were opinions obviously he developed over the past 2 weeks after reading the resolution, after dialogue with us. It was dropping on my shortcomings, not to have seen before they incorporated them before. So these weren't something he actually just saw the resolution and said, oh, this is wrong. As someone from the administration, he scanned through the resolution and this is the utmost that I did.
You are in administration,
and I think this is the utmost that he could come up with. I just want to know what else you are going to add to the resolution in terms of undergraduate advocacy. I think Emma Johnson pointed out to me last meeting, and many of you who voted against this actually supported that then, said that, you know, unnecessary interventions and unnecessary time spent in resolutions to pinpoint on small little matters should not be done. I think the point of this resolution is to create awareness about the sexism, and we do that by suggesting these things to the administration. The advocacy part is implied in the entire motive and intent of this resolution. But it's of course up to the House, and if someone wants to take this, they're most welcome to.
Yeah, you have a few seconds if you'd like to wrap up.
Okay. Well, basically, I do appreciate your response with that. And the question is my that, because I did submit the resolution several weeks ago. Unfortunately, because of a lot of events, it was pushed back. And I actually wanted to contact a few of these after I submitted the resolution. So that is why I was updated not until today. I completely forgot about this recommendation, actually. So it's my fault.
All right. So I do have a second speakers list that has been accumulating some names. I'm going to start going down it because it doesn't seem like there's anyone else who'd like to be on the first speakers list. Am I mistaken? Okay. First is Rep.
I just want to make a advocacy and including the resolution to make it more, have more teeth in making sure that there's the educational component. As you said before, you know, a lot of people don't know about the problem, and that's partly why there's so much of this discrimination happening. So I have to support VP We think that they are also making statements that I think that another week would be good.
Thank you. Earlier. That is a completely different issue. We look at the discrimination, that's a good demographic, but that is definitely another issue that hopefully we'll be able to work on in the future.
And the, I believe that title of your resolution could be changed because if you address it, you should address it completely, not partially.
Do you want a motion to change the title then?
No, I have a motion to table this so that there's more time to make a better resolution.
Okay, is that was a formal motion?
Yes, second.
So there's been a motion to table this until
next week.
There's been a second. Is there any dissent? All right, so Joseph, you have 30 seconds to explain your dissent. Okay, great. So we're going to go into voting whether we are going to table this or not. So, if you are in favor of tabling this resolution, please, until next week, please raise your placard. If you are opposed, if anyone would like to abstain. Okay. So, I vote as 7 to 13 to 2. It actually, this motion does fail. We will not be tabling this until next week at this time. Was that a point of information? Oh, call to question. So, there is a call to question on the floor. There's been a second. Is there any dissent?
Dissent.
You have 30 seconds.
What? I just think this is a very huge issue, and I think that there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion. I really don't think a lot of representatives in this room really understand the implications of this resolution, and thus I don't think it's appropriate for us to vote on it. I mean, I think we saw a major shift just within, you know, the past 20 minutes of this sort of intention of this resolution, what it's doing and you know, the scope of it. And I think that there's a lot more discussion that needs to be had there. I personally don't have a really great grasp of what's going on with this resolution right now, and I think a lot of other people in this room feel that way, and so I don't feel it's good for us to pass a sort of judgment on it.
All right, so we are going to vote whether to vote. No. All right. I'm sorry. If you are in favor of closing the discussion on this resolution and voting on it right now, please raise your placard. If you are opposed to closing discussion, you would like to discuss this more, etc., please raise your placard. If you'd like to abstain. So if I have a 9 to 11 to 2, the motion to vote failed, so we're not going to vote at this time. We will continue discussion. Would you like to be on speaker list? Okay, excellent. So by a vote of 9 to 11 to 2, we will continue discussion. I am going to pick up where we left off, I believe, versus VP Workshop.
So I have a question. So with the resolution, like maybe like next steps, one of the things that was also interested about is like I know a lot of students on this campus and maybe not directly related, but like do like persona studies, different surveys and things that they into like just like class related things, and a lot of times they ask for like your gender and things like that. So I'm wondering if like this or maybe another resolution or you can add it on to it, like to kind of describe that and like maybe say like you have the option of not including your gender or doing race law.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that that is definitely an issue. I know whenever I take surveys, that's where students take oftentimes they only have two options for gender. But that has to do with more of the advocacy, that's more of the educational aspect, because this has to do with official gender is more wrong that it's not. But yeah, I definitely think that education, it's more education about transphobia, especially with all forms of transphobia, would be beneficial moving forward.
Next is Ulysses.
First, I think it's really important. First, the university documents are not the first thing to study. That's the grant. That has to do with the university to make up the research. This has to do with the university stuff. I would say, I don't feel any type of way whether we table it or not. I think you know, more time is not a couple, but I do see value in actually working through the day. It doesn't matter to me. I think the bigger thing is if you had 2 weeks to be it already, I would, you know, most I would measure the ask how many of you actually reach out to the sponsors and ask them what the testimony is or how other broader LGBTQ issues are on campus. I would question that. That would be my first thing. The other thing would be, I think there is value in some time and maybe bringing more sponsors, and I would absolutely encourage a lot of the DJs earlier to work with the other assemblies. The reason why we're very specific in undergraduate systems is we were our department very specific in their jurisdiction of undergraduate and the employee. They actually like the idea of the employee and they're looking at doing the exact same thing, but at the same time, it's more of a jurisdiction issue as yet. Want to, you know, the advantage that I would say definitely take to the UA and say that this is something we want. Mission officers all operate pretty independently for the most part, so it's kind of one of those things we have to actually reach out to. Again, I think resolutions are a great step. I think most of it is a really great step. I think you all should also do a little bit more research too in the time that you have, in the time that you have, you should have probably done a bit more research to reach out to sponsors like Brian or other admins. And also, when you're getting things like this, diverse initiatives included or not, it's not an exception, you have to do research around the point. It's very hard to find stuff because they're so decentralized. Everybody, it's really designations, everybody has their own initiatives. So it's hard to kind of pull them all together and look and see what they're doing. But a lot of units are already doing stuff like this. It's just like
affirmation.
And affirmation can be doing things like that. So I would just say that. Research.
Could I just respond?
Sure.
I think I completely agree with what you said. That's one of the key points. So I watched the Easter Bank on the website and people voting in the community. The first point is the intent of the resolution hasn't changed at all. If you go by the amendments that have been brought in, it only needs a few more things, a little more specific for there to be more acceptance with the administration, and we can go into the details of these specificities. The second major point is that, I was recommended for this 2 weeks ago, and I would not want to raise this again. If the members voted against this were so keen, why did they not reach out for 3 weeks? This resolution was on the list for 3 weeks. They could have easily reached out for 3 weeks. They could have even Googled this topic 3 weeks ago and they could have worked on this. My third point is again something that Representative Johnson reprimanded me for is that our family doesn't have all the time in the world. We don't meet every day for 3 hours like this. We meet for limited amounts of time. We have many resolutions. This is a well-intended resolution which has correct language now. It has people who are sponsoring it, who will be pushing it to the MSPs. I will be working on this with the administration, with the UA, the welfare committee, things like that. So I think that's why I think it's a no-brainer. Just, I think, move ahead with this, pass it, and move on. That's what happens.
Okay, next is EVP Batista.
First of all, I think it's very important to commend you guys for all the hard work, and I also personally did some Google searching. I also think that the opinion is that, at least from my point of view, it's not to be defensive against the sponsors. I think this is a perfect example of how we should be going about the legislative process. Something should come across as new business. People should give input. You go back to the table. I'm sorry that there was that 2 week lag, and I understand the sense of urgency, but I do think that going to the UA, going to compliance, working with more members, that's the onus on members of the assembly to continue to focus on it, because I'd rather have language that is really strong, like present, like we never even added like a be it therefore resolved line, but maybe getting a formal statement from administration, which I think could also add some more impact. Actually, I just also kind of backtracking have a specific question. How will this actually appear on these surveys and whatnot? Because I've taken things like through psychology surveys where it's like there's a spectrum and then you kind of like it's a sliding bar and then you put it where you are in the sliding bar in terms of where you are from like homosexual to heterosexual. I've also seen like all these like there's like a multiple choice list where it's like 12 different options about how you identify with yourself. There's ones where it's just like male, female, other, which I'm not a fan of personally. And so I also just want to say, like, from my opinion, I think this is great because even though there's a lot of things that we can do in terms of advocacy, it really also is important for people that don't define necessarily the gender binary. And I think that when you're going to take a survey and seeing the comfort of having more options than just male or female is incredibly important to those students that don't define by the gender binary. So I think that's a really important first step, and that's why I think this is particularly really important. It's great to, like, educate the regular population, but it's also creating a sense of safe space for people that are on this campus, that even from something as simple as a survey, they're seeing that the university cares about understanding the whole spectrum of people and how they identify with different genders. So yeah, that's my time. I'd love to hear a response.
Great. And I just wanted to add that in terms of surveys and in terms of the work Pulse does, this isn't that is not us. I think they already recognize that there isn't a sex binary, and they already recognize identifying the gender. The second major point I want to make is that this is actually targeting two major forms of campus documents. The first is an admissions form. In the admissions form, many universities have the option to allow students to voluntarily, ascribe a specific pronoun to them. So we're asking for that, number one. And number two, for any administrative form, we're asking that instead of saying male or female, you give a gender option. That's all. It doesn't have to do with the survey.
Can I also say, what is the
to that? Can we just let the sponsors finish their response if they had anything?
I was going to say, I think you're right. And the other thing that I would add is the actual interaction is that it depends because, again, every unit is different.
Correct.
So what calls it that is of this updating, kind of the same way, the same for the employee survey, but when people from other colleges and units do their own surveys, they might ask it very differently, and that's just about it. It's not necessarily a mandate that they have to be a specific way, but it's because they ask questions. But there's a lot of research on that, and our application does essentially provide sample questions and things like this. So if people want that information, you have it available. So part of the key is to do so.
All right. Thank you all so much for your time. I am actually going to ask that we follow what Lindsay was talking about, just because Amanda came here today to speak with us and give us a little presentation about her job as the Judicial Codes Counselor and some of the things that she's observed recently. So I am going to ask that we move forward to her portion of the meeting. If her presentation is short and we do have time, we will go back to our discussion on Resolution 43. If we run out of time and the meeting does end up getting adjourned, again, it will be the first thing on the agenda next week, along with whatever resolutions that we did not have a chance to get to. We had a little bit of a busy meeting today, and I thank you all for being patient.
Hey, guys, can you see this? I thought you can.
If anyone would like to move their chair or sit anywhere in the room so that they can get a better view, including anyone in like the audience area, you should feel free to do that.
It's really
hard
for me to
say
I'm talking. Okay, hi, I'm Amanda Minnickett. I'm a third-year law student here at Cornell, and I am the Cornell University Judicial So, if you have heard that position, okay, who's heard today about the judicial position? Okay, so basically, you're going to liken that the prosecutor were the equivalent of like a public defender's office. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit about what our office is, what we do, and then how over the last year and a half, during our time working for the office, we've had a few ideas and few issues come to mind that we thought, after talking to Sarah, that we would bring these forward to you guys today and kind of get your opinion on some of the things that we have noticed, observations, et cetera. Okay, so next slide. So basically what our office is an office for law students, we're in training, and we operate within the different disciplinary systems here at Cornell. So that's academic integrity, code of conduct, and also the newly approved policies for cultural instruction in the system of sexual misconduct and discrimination. We're officially university employees. We get paid, we bill by the hour, and present support, and about 48 bucks or something, which is pretty cool. We do 2-year terms, and roughly in any given academic year, we see anywhere between 150 and 250 candidates. We have a lot of kids, you know, coming through our office. Our services are available to any member of the Cornell community, not just students. However, typically we only provide assistance to students just because, I don't know, faculty administrators cannot be in trouble and they're really not interested in seeking our advice. So, next. Alright, so within the Cornell disciplinary system, we have a kind of a privilege that's analogous to like confidentiality in the real world. Everything you tell us is confidential. For example, hypothetically, if I have somebody that got caught smoking marijuana behind the observatory, then over the course of adjudicating that ticket for CUPD within the campus disciplinary system, if it comes to my attention through our conversations that he's like a big time, I don't know, coke dealer or something, I'm under no obligation to go tell the university, and nor would I. So with that said, should outside litigation result, like sometimes there's criminal conduct that becomes comes to the attention of IPD or something, we can be subpoenaed because we're not really sure anything would go on with the confidential. So kind of an important distinction. So basically within the three different systems, we actually provide advocacy within the code of conduct. We're like representatives, we can take an issue to a hearing board, we'll act as a real attorney at your mini trial, and we won't have to say anything, and we're advocates. Within the code of, after the code of integrity, typically they want students to represent themselves, so we can help the students like prepare for the meeting with their professor, prepare for their hearing, and we can kind of whisper to them at the hearing, but we're not allowed to advocate on their behalf. And then similarly, under policy 6.4, we're more of a support assistance role rather than an advocate. So what I want to do really quickly is just talk about these three different realms. I don't know how familiar you are, hopefully you're not familiar with them at all, because you have not had to go through any of these processes. The first of which is academic integrity. So basically, if this is exactly how it's out, if you're accused of cheating, it could be homework, it could be plagiarism, it could be a final group project, that I don't know, you know, everything. Academic integrity, for you guys' awareness, is a very squishy, ill-defined thing. It varies by college. There's a lot of discretion. Basically, professors can do pretty much what they want. I saw a kid last year that went to a hearing who, the evidence against him was basically in the fact that the professor thought he cheated to his grade pretty good. I mean, he got acquitted and he got off. But it did go all the way through the process to that final stage. So this is just to illustrate how, in this world, how much discretion there is on the part of faculty. So those can be pretty challenging. Most of the time, these things are worked out at that golden part of the primary hearing professor, but occasionally, like I said, things are not solved, they go all over the board, and you get through students and then you get across them. Most of our violations we see are in computer science, which is probably FY, and then plagiarism issues within arts and sciences. Next. Okay. Code of conduct. This is where we do the bulk of our work. This is like, you know, underage drinking cases, public urination, fake IDs, possession of marijuana, what have you. Typically, a lot of our clients tend to be white male fraternity brothers. That's the way that it happens. And so we also do an outreach program. We try to go to fraternities and talk to them about the code of conduct and make them aware of our services. Basically, what happens is the students receive a referral from using the form of a CUP ticket. They have to call the DA and make an appointment. They go before the equivalent of the state, you know, the DA here at the campus, and they try to formulate some kind of plea bargain, which we call a summary decision agreement. If they don't agree, they can't negotiate into a resolution, then we go to a hearing board. And then at that time, we're calling a trial. You have students and faculty that sit before this hearing, you have opening and closing arguments, witness for that panel and they decide whether or not the student is in violation of the code. After which time they decide what sanction is appropriate, anything ranging from a written reprimand, whatever disciplinary record, all the way through expulsion. The burden of proof in these cases is clear and convincing evidence, so like the best way I can explain that is it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, it's not more likely than not, it's somewhere in the middle, probably around 70% certainty that whoever is not guilty is actually guilty. Again, most of our violations are alcohol and drug related, but most of those violations that go to actual court are usually assault, things involving weapons, or like more interesting cases than just alcohol and drugs. Next slide. Okay, so 6.4. Who here is aware of all the stuff going on in 6.4? Okay. So basically, back in 2011, the Department of Education sent out guidance from OCR saying that to basically provide guidance to students, to universities, to inform how they will be evaluated by the federal government in their experience with Title IX, which is like a big federal law pertaining to like discrimination. So essentially what happened is there was a mad rush around the country. All of the universities struggled to quickly become compliant with the recommendations in that letter. As a result, Cornell's response was to remove from the code of conduct all violations pertaining to sexual misconduct, harassment, and discrimination, and put them into a new policy. Because in order to be compliant with that guidance from OCR, it had to create a special process to handle these kinds of complaints. So basically, if you are accused of sexual misconduct at Cornell, you will not be prosecuted within the code of conduct system. It's different. You're going to be investigated, I guess you could say, underneath policy 6.4. And this is different because you have far fewer rights, really, is what it comes down to. Again, I just remember I'm on the defense side of the house, so I'm not a big fan of this. I realize that Cornell doesn't have a lot of choice. This is coming from a higher authority. However, if you are accused of one of those violations, it's pretty difficult to defend yourself. So, next slide. Basically, the key differences between university policy 6.4 and code of conduct is there is no trial. If you are the accused party, you do not get a right to review all the evidence against you. The investigator will see that, but you will not until everything is over. You will not be permitted to question any evidence against you. We recently tried to submit interrogatives via paper to the investigator to a couple of third party witnesses, and that was declined. So, additionally, there's no right for you to question the accused directly, which is a huge concern, and that makes sense because a lot of the reasons that victims don't report is because they don't want to have to face their assailant, and that makes tons of sense. However, in my opinion, 6.4 takes it a little bit too far and makes it such that you don't even have a right to question other witnesses against you. You also may not appear before your adjudicator. Everything is in writing. So you're relying on that third party, that investigator, to capture everything you said accurately and put it before the adjudicating authority on your behalf. So you have to hope that investigator is very impartial. Again, how we operate in this policy as far as our advocacy services, we're not allowed to advocate, we only advise. And then my favorite part, and this is coming from the Fed, not from Cornell, the burden of proof in these cases is a little better than 20 as to whether or not you are in violation or not in violation. And then this is the right. Okay, so basically with all that said, basically from our office operates in three different spheres. Okay, academic integrity, code of conduct, and sexual misconduct. With that said, our office is kind of like in a unique position to observe a lot of problems. And we do notice trends, and this is my second year in the office, and it's been interesting to have over 200 clients see different ways, not just how these policies are written on paper, but their implementation. Because a lot of times, as you guys know, stuff looks really pretty on paper, but then in practice, it looks a lot different. So, right now, our office is engaged not only with our core mission is in representing individuals in these various systems and providing individuals with assistance, but we're trying to get our voice heard in the different forms that are attempting to affect policy 6.4 and saying, hey, maybe the investigator in 6.4 should not also be the campus prosecutor. That's really not very impartial. Like, maybe that should be someone different. Because typically you don't have CPA responsible for our forensics data. So there's different feedback mechanisms that we're trying to use to get our operations to the right people to make changes to the right policies. So with 6.4, I kind of had it, you know, another big issue right now, as you guys know, is temporary suspension and abuse. In the code of conduct, temporary suspension is something that is delegated to presidential authority that is given to the JA. So basically, if there is on its face a complaint that alleges the student did something really bad, the JA has authority without investigating at all to suspend the bus campus. Well, that doesn't sound okay, that sounds like a good idea in theory, but when you think about how grave temporary suspension is, it means no access to your email, no access to Blackboard, you can't physically be on, it's termination of your status as a student. Even if it happens for 2 or 3 days before they get things voted out, it can have a detrimental result on your ability to succeed in the classroom. So what we found in the last 2 years, kind of just observing trends, is that the JA has started needing temporary suspension a lot more often, like 3 times as often as they did a year ago. So this is an operation that concerns us naturally, and we're trying to get that for the correct body, DJC, looking at 6.4, people that write that, I'm not really sure who they are right now, and then figure out exactly how we can word the language of these policies to kind of cut down on the discretion that is available to administrators to temporarily suspend students. Because right now, in all these policies, the standard for temporary suspension is different. So for example, in 6.4, JA can temporary suspension to protect the well-being of someone, which is very subjective, and it may not be reasonable. It's not a reasonable standard. Within the code of conduct, it specifically says it has to be a threat to the safety of the university community and to be used in extraordinary circumstances only. We would like that language reflected across all policies for uniformity and consistency. So that's just another little like battle that we're waging aside from our, again, primary function of defending individual students. Lots of issues in the code of conduct, I'm not going to go over those. We're putting those before the DJC to try to get them to revise some of the language there. Academic integrity, this will blow your mind. I don't know, I'm not going to ask more people that have been involved in academic integrity proceedings, but like I said, tons and tons of faculty discretion. Recently we had a case in which the professor didn't allow the students to see any of the evidence against them at all. And there's nothing really in the academic integrity policy that requires such. So we had a hard time making the argument, you know, how can the student properly defend themselves against these allegations if they don't know who's bringing the charges and what the charges are? That's still pending kind of matter. Additionally, procedural timelines. The academic integrity policy is silent on several periods of time. So from the time of primary hearing, when you sit down with the professor and they put the evidence, hopefully, before you and tell you what you've done wrong, they only have a short period of time before they can make a decision, and if they don't, then it goes to a hearing board. The issue that we had last year was the time that the cheating occurred to the time that the primary hearing of cheating was undefined. So we had a student that year and a half went by. He thought that he had completed the course, and then a year and a half later, finds out that the professor, and then the second semester senior, to find out what the professor believes he cheated a year and a half previously. So as a result, you can imagine how that impacted his opportunity for employment, but it's free on hold. Anyway, it's amazing how a small ambiguity or like gap in language can really have detrimental effects. So we were working with Joe Burns, the faculty, and trying to get some of those changes in the academic integrity policy as well. Alright, here's another type of trend that we see in our office. Last year I had a litany of cases like 10 students came in within a period of 3 weeks alleging that, you know, they were cited for possession of marijuana or something of that sort, alcohol being underage, and their rooms have been searched by campus police officers while they were in class. Right, privacy. That's really not cool. So my first instinct is like, oh, well, I'm sure there's a provision in the housing contract. When you sign over your life, you're thrown out and then you sign something away, right? Wrong. Nothing in the housing contract pertaining to expectation of privacy of the residents. That's insane. That really should be in there. That's important. So what we did is we went to the Deputy Police Station, we talked to him, he was a little bit, you know, appalled by this too. He was able to get some training and education for police officers, but the standard is still unclear. When can student rooms be searched? Does the RAC or the RA have delegated authority to allow a police officer to issue under the act? That question wasn't here right now, and that's a big deal. We need to know whether or not to find a shit where you're going to go. So that's one issue. Another issue is we saw a bunch of cases where GPD were stopping students on campus, without reasonable suspicion, demanding that they show their IDs, you know, and if you do that because it's private property, it's expected to be trespassing, but how likely is it that you're trespassing when you're leaving a library with a backpack and you're like you're 20 years old? Probably not very likely. So anyway, the point is that we had all these trends that were very concerning and we had nowhere to bring them. Try to talk to CCPD, try to talk to University Council, and again, not to mention, this isn't our job. We're public defenders. We should not supposed to be concerned with policy-related issues. At the same time, it's really important to make somebody aware of this stuff. Additionally, other stuff that we see in our office, we get a lot of emails, kids asking for help with landlord tenant issues because they misunderstand our role. We're not real attorneys. I can't help you negotiate your rental contract with your landlord, unfortunately. And there is currently nothing in place at Cornell that provides free legal assistance to students for those types of issues. Also, there's a lot of issues sometimes with financial aid and tuition, whether or not someone's aid came in correctly, whether or not a loan was processed correctly, and students ending up owing a lot of money when it's just some staffing or problem back in some financial aid office. And then the students struggle not knowing what their rights are. Can I put them on the diploma? Can I not? Can I register for the next semester? Can I not? How do I come up with this money to pay this debt? Or what if I don't even believe I own it and it's all Cornell's fault? There's nothing in place to deal with that. So next up. So talking to some of the student assembly members recently, and we talked about how we need something somewhere that's responsible for receiving feedback from places like the JCC office, kind of documenting trends, figuring out who the key players are, identifying where the solution should be. Is it an interpretation issue? Is it that we need to revise the policy? Is it that we can write a new policy? And then coming up with that, and then kind of like providing feedback to administrators and policy owners in that respect. Next. So like, I started researching other identity institutions, and it's amazing that Cornell doesn't have this, because it seems like most other IDB schools have some kind of student rights committee, for lack of a better word, to call it anymore. An entity responsible for monitoring, codifying, and ensuring that students are aware of their rights on campus. Additionally, most other schools have this thing called a student bill of rights, which is sort of like a preamble to all of the rights and responsibilities that are contained in various policies, including code of conduct, academic integrity. We don't have one of those. So what we were thinking is if we developed or figured out where to put this committee or this entity, they could be responsible for drafting and maintaining the student bill of rights on an annual basis, because those policies are updated annually, ensuring that the most up-to-date versions of those policies are in one place, because right now, if you attempt to go online and find a policy, it's all over the place. You're stuck at making it accessible. And a lot of times, it's not the students, it's parents. Parents want to know what is expected of my child, they can't find it, because it's not on that list. So this entity would be responsible for compiling those policies, ensuring that the updated versions were available, and then additionally serving as that feedback mechanism for all issues related to student rights. So one other area that I didn't mention was the grief system. The grief system has its own sort of like, judicial thing going on, and students and organizations related to that have their own rights and benefits. That's another thing that could be added to this book if you want to follow that. Your rights against campus police. It'd be really nice to know what my rights are when a campus police officer approaches me on foot day. Like, do I have to answer questions? No, you don't. But it'd be nice to know what you should say, which is usually like something like, am I detained, am I free to go? But a lot of people are unaware of what their rights are and how they navigate those situations respectfully. So this would be another place to put that. Again, issues with landlord tenant status, issues that affect student rights is related to the city of Ithaca. This is going to be responsible for all of that. I could coordinate with the University Council to make sure that the advice they're promulgating is in fact lawful. Coordinate with CCPD when police officers are, you know, operating a little bit out of their jurisdiction, which they do frequently. That feedback can be routed with work related to CCPD so they can be held accountable. And then establishing also a monitoring program through which students can receive free or discounted legal assistance for real attorneys out of town related to like criminal or civil issues that are on the campus. So that is my idea, kind of to explain our role, which informs our vantage point, and then talk to you guys about our idea. So with that. Are you guys ready? I know I'm the last person on the agenda, so everyone's really alive right now.
Well, thank you so much, Amanda. Hopefully that clarified some things for you guys. I know that the student Bill of Rights thing was brought up last week, and I tried to explain it briefly. I think Amanda did a really nice job of further explaining where that idea came from. And if it's okay with you, Amanda, I think we have some people who have questions. All right, so first the math taglia. You can say it if you want.
Our thought was that obviously we're going to create a new entity that's responsible for student rights. That is a big deal. Like, I wish you could see what I think. I wish you could see the crap that TUP does to students and how there is no effective mechanism for controlling some of it. So, anyway, with that said, we think that this, if there's enough work that could be done by this committee that it deserves its own, like, I don't know, the place, perhaps, of the UA. So the resolution in order to get it, to bring it into existence, we have to originate with the CJP, be approved by the UN president and establish it. But I envision, and I got wrong, that I don't know what I'm talking about, that committee drafting the Bill of Rights on behalf of the students. Like, so the CJP would not be in charge of the Bill of Rights. The relationship between the CJP and the committee would be the CJP would have to, on an annual basis, provide an updated code of conduct to them so that they can compile it and put it behind the bring forward the Bill of Rights. So there would be, like, I don't know, a single annual submission and then constantly liaison, because a lot of the student rights issues arise in the code. There's a problematic language that suddenly comes up with the GA, and suddenly the guys have started to bring a violation in a new exciting way. And so this, I could go to this committee and be like, look, this is what we're seeing. They can coordinate with the CJP and the University Council so that our office doesn't just read on time to do it, you know? So there would be like an ongoing relationship with the feedback mechanism. But the Bill of Rights, I would say, is actually owned by this committee. That would be their document.
Yeah, so,
yeah, starting
off
with the CJP
last
week,
I was also going to being on CJC, we meet once every 2 weeks about, and it's essentially how much work anybody does on that is essentially like a hobbyist perspective on it. You can do like a lot of work for it, you can read everything you want, or you can come to the day, contribute, talk a lot, and none of it really happens, which like that happens to. So I would highly recommend that it not be within the committee system, that it's like the shared governance, because that system is run by people on their free time. This is
Bill of Rights, because it's important to science, it's going to require it to come from the committee,
So, if I can clarify a little bit, I mean, I think there is some flexibility for us when we do finally draft this resolution to suggest that it is a committee under the university, because they do kind of have their own committees. Exactly. So we could request for it to be a council. We're still kind of trying to figure out how those are established, and I've been looking into it with little success, but I think for right now we're at least going to try to use the avenue of the UA to get this conversation rolling, and if we can figure out where a good home for this is, I think it's still appropriate, even if the home is not within the shared governance system, I think it's appropriate for us to start out by passing a resolution through the CJC and then UA.
I think it's about getting the right people. I think also, like, if you have enough experience with some of the cases that we've seen where students have their lives just maybe disproportionately or miserable and they get it wrong, like, you become really, I don't know, like, very good and you care a lot. But perhaps the solution, you mentioned, like, maybe getting someone that's hired to do it. Is it a possibility to have a kind of hybrid thing where it's elected people plus, I don't know, a field lawyer from out of town that is, like, in charge, perhaps, of the legal assistance portion that can also provide actual, I don't know, legal things on the bar, so I'm not qualified, but, you know, like, that perspective as well, and then maybe the university pays them for that?
Anything is possible, but it gets complicated when you start asking for money. I can tell you that from experience. But, yeah. But that's something that we can look into, for sure.
And just, like, the mystery of student professor student administrative discussions, like, people bringing in their own state as a professor, as a member of the UA, or as an EA, going to represent them on the UA, I just can't imagine that producing anything robust or possible. I don't think that.
Yeah. Is it okay if I move on to another question because we're running low on time? Philip?
Well, I just want to agree with everything that Joseph just said. And I also want to stress that for ones who have not gone through this process, I've been on both sides of the process, being tried by the university as well as someone who has tried someone else at the university. That is, for me, for him, very ambiguous with what I could do and what I couldn't do, and no one really knew. So I think this is incredibly important and not stress. It's paramount to us.
Yeah, nobody really cares if they'll have it to you. You know? Like, nobody looks up the academic career policy or puts on that for something or something and then can't find it. And then you don't know who they're going to have to do it, so.
Max, do you want to come up and use the mic? Okay.
A couple of small things. I was talking to on the Common Council, and they were talking about landlord-tenant issues, and the university doesn't want to be involved in liability reasons, that any kind of relationship at all would constitute some way of financial relationship, even if there's no money changing hands, which is really weird. And also the, there are a lot of fraternity alumni who are now attorneys, and they routinely do a small amount of pro bono work for their frat. They would probably be very interested in an opportunity to affect the actual campus code. I was talking with some attorneys who are attorney alumni here. Bill Shaw is very interested in 6.4. Things like that, and also, I know this probably wouldn't be
Columbia has a great for them. There is an issue. I think that they were looking at having university council provide assistance to students, and they can't because they are not essentially university. So there is definitely a compromise with that. Another thing that we explore when we were planning at the law school, we provide who can do real legal work, and we should provide work on management issues. The issue is the credit hour. We cannot predict how much work you're going to get in the semester. So if you enroll in a class like that, then you might not be able to get it into your credit. But the law school was not excited about supporting that idea. This would look more like something that is removed from Cornell, so that Cornell could kind of like not be held liable for any, I don't know, like assistance to counsel. So it would be, there would be a pot of money there available to students who could apply for it and use it to get help them to turn it out in town. And that would be a legal relationship. And then, or even just a free amount of time for willing to volunteer and provide pro bono or receive great services, then the university can distance itself from that. It should be relationship all around. But a lot of schools do this.
Columbia,
okay. Columbia actually has great everything.
What is your thought? What do you think? All right. So a couple of things. So the whole legal assistance thing is something that Yamini and Annie O'Toole have been working really hard on this year, and it's kind of nebulous. So if you guys have any ideas, suggestions, basically everything that we were just talking about is something that we have already thought about and is something that we're trying to get done. Before we move on with questions, I know it is 6:37. Maybe a lot of you, including Amanda, have other places to be. I know the bear was supposed to come so we could take a picture. Oh, okay. So the bear was supposed to come so we could take a picture. I don't know where the bear is. If you really have to go and don't care whether or not you are in this picture, then that's okay. Otherwise, I think that we should continue with the question and answers as long as Amanda has time. If not, I will stay and answer everyone's questions in this manner until the bear arrives, and we can even continue after. Is that okay? Okay. So next is Yamini. If you want to ask a question, raise your hand so that I can keep track.
Yeah, so I guess to provide a little bit of context about the legal advising thing, the reason I thought of it was because one of my friends got in trouble and had no idea what to do, and like was a bio major and came to me as an ILR major to provide some legal assistance, I guess. So that's I guess why I started thinking about this. And after that, I reached out to the law school, so I spoke to Dean Lucendale from the law school. The advice she gave me was essentially that, you know, I wanted to have it so it was like a program for law students that they could provide legal assistance. But the issue is that they have, as you were saying, they have to be supervised by a law professor, and it's like really difficult to coordinate something like that, especially because you don't know how many people are going to utilize the service. So in terms of coordination, she didn't feel like that was the best way to do it. But she was willing to give us like a list of lawyers that she thought would be good for this kind of a service. So I think in terms of funding, the options, I mean, if you look at comparable universities, like Duke, the way that they do it is that they have like a legal advising service that goes through their student government. So like you can schedule it like with your student government. Like it's like on their website. You can be like, hey, like I want to meet with a lawyer, and you do it through them. So that's one model. Other models could be like using this committee. But I think the key thing is that like I think it is important to keep it a little bit separate from the university, just because like a lot of these things are against universities. So in that sense, I mean, in terms of if anyone has any structural ideas, that would be really helpful for us, I guess, going forward too.
All right, so apparently the bear and the photographer have arrived. For those of you new members who still need to take your photograph, and we will all take a group picture together. One last question before Amanda leaves, make a quick background.
Yeah, so
what are the next steps that you can all do in the family? Like, honestly, I'm surprised that there's actually going on.
this literally just happened. Okay. Started happening two weeks ago. I promise we are not hiding everything.
This is good stuff to talk about.
Our office is typically, we're locked, so we're really, really busy. And I think the people that have been in this meeting before have just struggled in finding the good fight for each individual case and never really thought about, oh, how do I go bigger picture if this doesn't happen anymore? And so a lot of it is took us some time to figure out who owns these policies, who is responsible for providing feedback, and it's very disjointed. So the people at the CPC that are, or whatever the hell they are, that do the academic and everything, who even are these people? Like, where do they meet? Who's responsible? Is it possible to get a freaking email answered? And we had some with the kids that had a year and a half long matter heading and then didn't graduate on time. I mean, it was ridiculous. Honestly, I think my personal perspective of that is the racist, the professor had an identity to do that. But that aside, that should not be overcome. And so the time it took for us to figure out how to make the change took us a year. So that's due to us not having more people, it's due to us not knowing where to go, and it's due to us being all our time bogged down with like helping individual students, which is the most important thing. So if we have this committee that could receive these problems, not just from us, from anybody anymore in the community. It's like, yeah, I saw some bullshit happen in the art squad the other day, and it just bothered me. Like, I witnessed it. You know, whether it's the way that security was being done, an event, or whatever, that would be the point of contact for receiving kind of complaint. Right now, something else that's really interesting, and I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but say you have an interaction, police brutality is a huge issue there. Say you have an interaction with a DPD officer that you think was unfair, like they used excessive force, or they breached his profile of you. If you walk into DPD right now at Barton Hall and try to wage a
there's no way to do it. They do not have, even though they're deputized in the county and they're state actors and it's technically required for them to have some formal system to receive complaints, file them permanently, and follow up. They don't have to sit down with a hospital sergeant, talk to somebody, you're not really going to do it at a protection to go complain, and then you never hear back from them. You don't know if the officer that made the mistake ever really corrected or addressed. There's no accountability for it. And that's just one issue. That's I'm talking about code of academic integrity, code of conduct, 6.4, every policy, regulation, and action that affects student life and the lives of behaviors, like this committee would have a lot of work. And huge, really important. So in terms of like spreading awareness and those issues, I don't know what we can do right now until we have an agency that has the authority and legitimacy to make change. In terms of spreading information about our topic, it's very difficult. Like I tried to get money, for example, to advertise JCP services for a year and a half, and Dan has been I was denied again to get posters made, just posters, like the ones that go on Baltimore and like the residents all. We asked to send out the campus-wide email each semester, that seriously didn't happen. Like, I'm not trying to just like cry in tears here, but we're not the favorite, you know, with the administration. So we have
All right, guys, I'm so sorry that we have to cut you off. I know you also have to go to class. So if you guys, yeah, give Amanda another round. I am going to adjourn the meeting at this.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.